Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Julia LaRose Show. Today's guest is Keith Fitzgerald. He is the principal of the Fitzgerald Group. Keith has been in markets for over 40 years, and if his name sounds familiar to you, it's because he was one of a handful, maybe just a few lone voices, last year in 2023 calling for the S&P 500 to rise to his call, 4750, which he absolutely nailed. In this episode, Keith shares his outlook for markets, and we've already blown past his target for 2024 of 5,200. He explains where markets could head next if the Federal Reserve stays on the sidelines and why he still sees an opportunity to buy. I really enjoyed this conversation with Keith. It was packed full of optimism and lessons, and I hope you all enjoy this one as much as I did. Keith Fitzgerald, principal of the Fitzgerald Group. It is so great to welcome you to the show. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me today, Keith.
It is my pleasure. What an honor. Thanks for having me.
Well, I am so excited to have you. And I want to kick things off where I always start with my guest, Keith, and that is to get their big picture macro view, the framework in which they're looking at the world today. And one of the things about this show, Keith, is you can take all the time you need to set the table, if you will, when it comes to that macro view.
Oh my goodness, you're very kind. So I'm a simple guy, right? I think that people like to make investing in the financial markets very complicated, but the reality of the situation is that simple is better. Investing in optimism is better. Knowing where the world is going is better than the alternative, because I'm more interested in being profitable over time than I am interested in being right at moments in time. So I see the world through five big picture lenses. We call them the five D's. And these five D's, what makes them special is they're not just themes. They're where our world is going. They're how humanity is changing. So every one of them is backed by trillions of dollars that's going to get spent no matter who's in the White House, no matter what the Fed does next, no matter what happens in Israel, Gaza, the Middle East, Russia, Ukraine, et cetera. So those are the lenses through which we look at things. And once we figure that out, it becomes a relatively simple exercise to move forward.
But you mentioned the five D's, is that right?
Five D's, yeah.
Okay, so what are the five D's?
Okay, great question. So digitalization, and I'm not talking about digitization. That's like putting your x-rays on a disc and taking it to your doctor. I'm talking about digitalization. So this is our world. There's diffusion, defense, dislocation, and disruption. And so all of those things are the five D's. And each one of those things has trillions of dollars backing it, money that will get spent that's moving forward. So I would submit there's an awful lot of opportunity in all the chaos around us.
And wait, there are there other ones?
No, that's just the five.
Wait, five D's, digitalization.
Digitalization, defense.
Okay. Defense.
Diffusion.
Okay. Yep. Ah, okay. And then diffusion and?
Distribution, dislocation.
Okay, dislocation. Got it. Okay, five D's. Okay, so what I'm hearing from you when I ask you about the macro view, maybe that actually doesn't matter all that much. Does the Fed matter? Do you have a take there? Because it seems like, gosh, there's a lot of focus on, their interest rate policy going into the year, expecting six cuts, and then, that's not going to happen. So what's your take on the Fed?
Well, I'm chuckling because I was, I was uninvited unceremoniously from every cocktail party on Wall Street for the next 1,000 years because of my view on the Fed. I think they're so far out to lunch, they're an insult to people who are actually out to lunch. They're as wrong about rates and labor today as they were about transitory. And as far as I'm concerned, the Fed is an antiquated institution playing with out-of-date models staffed by a bunch of people who have very little, if no, understanding of how real money actually works. So yeah, they're an input, but am I going to hover and am I going to just dissect every single statement that they make? No way, because the only thing that matters in today's world is how today's highly leveraged traders and funds think the Fed is going to react to any minute data point. If they, if rates go up, for example, risk goes up, they think the Fed's, oh boy, the Fed's going to raise rates, going to hold them higher for longer. So they start selling. If they think, oh, this is good, and the rates are going to go down, then they start buying. So, as an investor, you want to take a deep breath, get away from that, stop trying to second guess the unguessable, and start looking at the stuff that matters. That's actually the CEOs. That's the companies that are putting up great numbers despite it all, the companies that can change consumer behavior. Because history shows, regardless of the Fed or who's in the White House or any of those other big macro concerns that are so cross-current at the moment, that's the stuff that actually makes you money.
Interesting. So how people, investors, think the Fed is going to act. So when you look at it from that lens, how do you kind of assess the situation or read the situation based on like how the investors are thinking about the Fed?
Well, again, you know, I maintain, and this is not a popular viewpoint, I maintain that the Fed is off here in left field somewhere. If you want to be a profitable investor, you want to take a page from the playbook of somebody the likes of Warren Buffett or the likes of Ray Dalio or the likes of Ron Barron or, you know, Sir Mark Mobius, Dr. Mark Mobius or Sir John Templeton. You know, these are folks who said, okay, we're going to put all that away aside. It's important. But, you know, beyond that, we're going to get down to brass tacks here. And so I'm in the brass tacks camp. I want to focus on companies like, for example, Apple or Palantir or Chevron that have great, huge, sweeping demand for the products, for the goods and services they make, because the world cannot live without what they do. And I call those must-have companies, not nice-to-haves.
Got it. Okay, so you mentioned some names, and they probably fit into that framework that you are laying out, the five Ds.
Yep.
Okay, walk us through what are the interesting opportunities for you in the market right now, and then I'll have some follow-ons.
Sure. So the biggest opportunity is AI. I mean, bar none. That just catapulted into the public's consciousness last year. I've been working with this trend for a better part of a decade now, but it really blossomed last year when people begin to be aware of it. You know, Microsoft absolutely caught everybody flat-footed when it released its model. Google instantly went into defensive catch-up mode. So that's something that is going to not just be a tech, which is how most people are thinking about it, and this is the mistake they're making. It potentially is the greatest technology in recorded mankind's history. It's going to change the course of how we live and how our world functions. So that to me is one of the greatest single opportunities there is. It's going to be enough to power this market and the right companies for decades to come, not just the next 6 months, not just the next 6 weeks, decades to come. So the key for me is, you know, which companies are driving it, how are they driving it, who's going to benefit from it? Because, you know, we talk about it in very simple terms again. Every business on the planet is going to adapt, adopt, or die. When it comes to big data, every business right now is using it, you know, on average, something like every 18 seconds, three quarters of the planet tunes into some element of big data. As we begin to learn and manipulate, that number is going to go up. And as that becomes more widespread and, you know, use cases continue to blossom, we're going to see it in every aspect of our lives, from the gas station on the corner to our dry cleaners, to our grocery stores, to, you know, even how we live our lives in our homes.
Yeah. I've heard it described as like the greatest innovation, not just like in our lifetime, but like any human's lifetime. So yeah. when you have like your AI universe of names and opportunities, can you give us the names that you're thinking about? Like NVIDIA, Google, Microsoft, where are you allocated, or which ones are the most interesting to you in that space?
Well, you know, again, because of the way I view the world, right? You know, this is the time to buy the haystack, not go looking for the needle. And, you know, that's because of the Fed. That's because of geopolitics. That's because the world is complicated. So you want to stick, ironically enough, with these great big names that have the fortress-like balance sheets, that have the widespread millions and millions and millions of consumers, all of whom are moving huge amounts of ideas and currency, both literally and figuratively, through the system. So, you know, I'm looking at the NVIDIAs, I'm looking at the Microsofts of the world. I don't really care about the small players that are just putting AI after their name, because that doesn't interest me from either a philosophical standpoint or a profit potential standpoint, because the big companies are buying all of the private guys before they get public. Therefore, they're the ones where you want to focus.
Mm-hmm. Let me step back from, you know, specific sectors and opportunities and just point something out for the folks who are watching and listening. Last year, going into 2023, a lot of folks were super bearish, expecting recession and whatnot. And you were one of the few names, like just not even a handful, like a couple names, that nailed the S&P 500 price target for the year end. I think your target was 4750. You can correct me if I'm wrong.
That's correct.
But, yeah. Okay. So you nailed the call there. I mean, a lot of like chatter right now about markets and performance and where we could be headed. Can you give us more of your broader market outlook, and what are the factors that you're paying attention to? What is kind of your thesis right now, and has anything shifted or changed or been reinforced for you?
Wow, there's a lot to unpack there. So first of all, thank you for remembering that. Yeah, that was a very controversial set of remarks when I made last year. You know, I came in saying we're going to be 47-50 at the end of the year, and people all thought I had gone around a bend and lost my marbles, but we actually finished within a half of 1% of that. So, you know, this is a very, very tough business. And it was really nice to hit one out of the home run like that, especially when we got some of the names like NVIDIA and Microsoft and Apple and even Tesla, which ran up repeatedly over 100+% in the timeframe we were looking at it. So this year, I still see an awful lot of capital on the sidelines. The fear and uncertainty that is causing a lot of people doubt right now is, if you look throughout history, a wonderfully remarkable and resilient signal to buy if you know what you're doing and you latch onto the right companies. So I look at this and I say, well, you know, investing in optimism is inevitably always the better path to profits. If you want to cower in pessimism, that ain't going to do it. You may be right at moments in time, but if you're interested in 3, 4, 5, 10 years at a shot, that's the kind of stuff where optimism rules. And again, if you at the absolute top tier, best names only, keep it on the fairway time, then I think, you know, odds are you're going to do okay.
Yeah. You wrote a book over a decade ago, and there was a line in there too around that. Like, Fiscal Hangover was the book, but it was like you were most excited about the opportunities post-credit crisis. So kind of walk me through that too. Like, how do you get into that mindset where are you buying right now in this environment? Just kind of curious, like, okay, you are buying.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Because one of the things, you know, so I've been very, very fortunate to have a number of great mentors in my life, and one of whom I unknowingly just drove it through my thick skull that the point at which you want to buy for maximum opportunity is the point at which others are selling despondently. Now, people may recognize that as Sir John Templeton, and that's correct. You know, doubt is a great profitability play if you know what you're doing. So when I looked at the credit crisis, you know, chaos creates opportunity. And it was that way in the dot-com crash. It was that way in the global financial crisis, both of which I was very fortunate to see coming ahead of time. COVID, same thing. You know, anytime you get angst, it's like yelling fire in a movie theater. Everybody runs for the same door. But what studies show is that people don't understand there's an alpha in a door right next to you. If you just take a look around and look, you know, one of my other mentors said, you know, if somebody's waiting, everybody thinks they know something about a trade, you want to look at the other side of it because the possibility really exists that if they think you're out of your mind, you're onto something. So am I buying? Yes. I'm not throwing caution to the wind, but I'm being very careful. I'm sticking within those 5 D's. I'm looking for the big names. I'm looking for all the people who've got great management, fortress-like balance sheets, making those must-have products and services. It's a consistent theme that has worked throughout history. And I'm a big fan of studying history because it may not repeat, but it rhymes. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about last year, 5 years, 500 years ago. Market history shows that angst is, in fact, a great opportunity if you can get through it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pointing out like the history that it rhymes, does this time, I mean, you've been in markets for like, what, 40 plus years at this point?
Oh,
like,
God.
Sorry, yeah. you've been in a while, for a while. So
43
does it rhyme?
43 yeah. years. I can't even believe it. I've made my first trades using money that I saved up cutting lawns when I was a kid.
Yeah. Well, does this time remind you of any other time that you've seen in your career, or even just studying financial history? Are you kind of like seeing like maybe a bit of a deja vu out there?
Oh man, I that's a great question. And yes, you know, it's funny because when I started making my first trades in the late 80s, mid 80s, early 80s, actually really, you know, Russia just invaded Afghanistan. I mean, like, here we go again. We had concerns in Asia. Everybody was worried about China, which was just reopening at the time. The headlines were overwhelmingly negative. People thought the markets were going to go to hell in a handbasket. So, you know, I look around at what's happening today, and you know, this is, gosh, I hate to admit it, but this is roughly the third or fourth major, you know, catastrophic crisis that I've lived through. Now, I never thought, frankly, I'd be investing on the cusp of what is potentially another world war, but let's hope cooler minds prevail. But yeah, there's very definitely a sense of deja vu there for me.
You know, speaking of the geopolitics, how does that impact like investor psychology or behavior? How do you think about it? How do you think about it impacting markets and then like being able to see entry points or stay invested rather? Like, how much does it affect things?
Well, that's a sharp question. You know, the answer is it affects it a lot, but for the wrong reasons. You know, I've worked with tens of thousands of investors over the year. We've been very, very fortunate to have our research read widely around the world. And one of the things I've noticed talking to people just consistently is their emotions inevitably get the better of them. And the problem with that is they start focusing on playing not to lose, when history shows what you want to do is play to win. And they're very, it sounds, you know, like I'm just like pitching a coin here or being trivial, but I'm not. It's a very subtle distinction that matters tremendously in terms of the results you achieve. And the way to get past all the stuff that roils markets is not to get caught up in those short-term timeframes. Everybody thinks that that's what they've got to do, but Wall Street's playing them like a $5 fiddle. Wall Street wants people unsettled and uncertain because that's how they know they're going to trade. It makes it easier for the big traders to separate uncertain investors from their money. If you've got somebody who knows what they're doing, who's purchased the right company for the right reason, that person is not going to let go of that stock without a darn compelling issue or darn compelling reason to do so. Wall Street moves on. They have no interest in fighting those battles. They're going to go for the easy money every time. So, you know, to me, this is a market of tremendous confluence, a tremendous of complexity. But if you take a deep breath and you step back, it actually gets quite simple. We have a saying in this office, when in doubt, zoom out. And that's very much the operative principle now.
Mm-hmm. You say when you zoom out, it gets quite simple. Explain that to me.
I'd be happy to. You know, many of the things that bother you day to day, you know, simply vanish. Because, for example, if you look at, and we run these statistics every night, because again, you know, I was king of the propeller heads when I was growing up. I was, you know, it just, numbers are how we live and breathe this marketplace, right? And so if you're looking tomorrow, what's the higher probability of an opening tomorrow? You know, this morning's report said it's 53.15%, right? But if you go out 3 to 5 years, that number jumps to 80, 81, 82, 83%, right? If you go out 10 years, a decade from now, that number is now going to be between 93 and 94%. So if you could go to Vegas and you had a 94% odds of winning at your favorite table game, would you take the bet? Odds are you probably would. So here's the thing is, you know, probabilities, not possibilities in my world. And I think, again, using history the way we do, viewing history the way we do, looking at these companies, I think we can paint a very compelling picture that investing in optimism is exactly what you want to do, especially when people least expect it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so turning back to markets and opportunities, we mentioned a handful of the tech names. Talk to me about like what else is interesting to you from an investment opportunity? And like, are you kind of someone who just goes after like a few names, or are you more broad? Like how do you kind of put together a portfolio?
Well, our view is very simple. You know, our research shows that anything beyond about 20, 25 names or so, you are over diversifying. In fact, you're adding more risk to your portfolio, but not the potential for returns. And so you're effectively playing not to lose. And that's a great, that is a fundamental misunderstanding of how the principle of diversification works. So for us, it's all about concentration. You know, and I had a hunch this might come up. So let me reach for my numbers here. Let me see if I have this. I'll make this point. But you know, if we look at the S&P 500, indexing, buying the index is a very popular thing to do. So even with all the selling after, you know, last couple of days, the S&P 500 is up roughly 90% or so. And that's over the last 5 years. Over the last 10 years, 236%. But if you start talking about concentration, like I'm talking about, start talking about Apple or Nvidia or any of these other names, you know, Nvidia was up 1,765% over the last 5 years and 20,543% over the past 10 years. So the question isn't, do you own the index? The question is, do you own enough of the companies that are positioned to win? And you can run a similar exercise with Apple or Microsoft or any of those other names. So if you play to win, it becomes a very, very different scenario. I think we want to play for bullseyes. We want to hit and we want to connect with the pitches. We don't want to be just spreading our money around willy-nilly because history shows that's not what you want to do if you really want to win.
Got it. Okay. So 20 to 25 names, play to win. I don't know if I nailed you down on this one earlier, but do you have a price target in mind for this year for the S&P 500? Did you share an outlook there or has it changed?
Sure. Okay. Sure. As a matter of fact, we already took that out. I said 5,100, 5,200. We took that out pretty early. So we're working on those numbers now, trying to figure this out. If we can get the Middle East to calm down and the Fed stays on the sidelines, you know, I'm thinking 5,500, 5,600 may be the next stop. But, you know, it's very much a number that's a work in progress. And the reason is something that most people don't expect. The reason is there's still an awful lot of money on the sidelines, still a lot of money in debt instruments to come rushing back into the right stocks. The market is going to get more and more concentrated in those big names, we talked about. That's going to be what propels it higher, because then you get FOMO, then you get all the computers piling in, you get everybody wanting to catch the train as it's leaving the station. So there's an awful lot of upward momentum, but we've got to get through the geopolitics first, and the Fed's got to get to the sidelines.
Mm-hmm. You were critical of the Fed at the top of this, and a lot of folks that come on the show are, so it's all right. When you say stay on the sidelines, does that mean just stay higher for longer? Or like, what does that mean exactly, like stay on the sidelines?
Well, again, you know, I was very early in the water in this and came under a lot of pressure from a lot of my colleagues as a result of this, many of whom now adopted the same narrative. The Fed has a fiscal problem. They don't have a rates and labor problem like everybody thinks. And so when I say stay on the sidelines, you know, I think, again, the Fed should take away the microphones, for example. I think they should get rid of this dot plot. The less the Fed says, the better, because then the markets can actually react based on the mechanics of the markets and the value of the companies, not based on this perception of what the Fed might or might not do as a function of leverage. And you know, this is stuff that doesn't get talked about. The average retail investor does not understand what's happening behind the scenes. So they're completely flummoxed by the volatility that we're seeing. To me, it's like a signpost. You know, I know that when that volatility happens, A, it's an opportunity, and B, you've got these massive funds that are just leveraging and deleveraging, which is what carries this thing up and down. Longer term, I know it's going to be this way because the markets have an upside bias over time. So that doesn't faze me. It doesn't worry me. I wouldn't be very good at my job if it did. But it does create the opportunity, and that's the part people don't understand. They cower in fear when, in fact, they should be running to it.
Interesting. You mentioned the Fed has a fiscal problem. Can you explain that?
Sure. And again, people were going to hear that. They're going to say, oh, they're immediately going to default to politics. I don't do politics. I do money. I don't care. Red, blue, I don't care. That's not my job. You know, we may agree and we may not agree. It doesn't matter to me. The only thing that does matter to me is how do we make money in this scenario? And what we know over time is that big government equals small wallet. Doesn't matter who's driving the boat, right? And so what I want to see is a Fed that stays on the sidelines. I want to see a Fed that can work with the policy mandate it has. It's a stable pricing. But in order to do that, they've got to get money out of the system. And unfortunately, we have become, as a nation and many central banks around the world, addicted to cheap capital. So they continue to throw more money into the system. But the problem is not that there's not enough money. The problem is there's too much. There's too much money having this. So think about it this way, right? If you go to the grocery store to buy the last egg and you're one of 1,000 people that wants that egg, the price is going to go just screaming higher, right? Because of scarcity. That's economics 101. If you are one of 1,000 people and there's 100,000 eggs, then the price of those eggs is going to come down until every last one of them gets sold. But what happens if there's 10 eggs and suddenly every one of those thousands of people has been given a couple grand to go? Well, now all of a sudden the price of the egg no longer represents the price of the egg. The price of the egg represents who's got money in their pocket. That's the stock market today. Who's got money in their pocket? That's why we see the volatility we do. The egg is almost irrelevant.
Yeah. So do you think, when you step back, do we have healthy markets? Do we have I'll ask you a two-part question. Do we have healthy markets and do we have a healthy economy?
Oh boy, this is an interesting one because, you know, it is possible to be an economic bear and a market bull, mm-hmm. right? People don't think so, but it is. And history, again, shows that, right? So healthy, let's define healthy. You know, is it working the way we'd like to see it work? No, probably not, because I think price discovery and a lot of the other assumptions that fundamentally made up the markets of the past no longer exist. So, you know, some people would say that's unhealthy. But if we're talking purely about market mechanics, they've never worked more fluidly. We've never had better price transition efficiency, you know, computerization, all those things have resulted in a market that is very, very liquid. Where I would submit the markets are broken and challenged is we have a bunch of regulators who don't really understand how the system is working. We have the influence of dark pools, the rise of passive investing, the use of leverage, all of which is confusing to the average investor who feels like they're beat up and getting mugged every time they turn on the television and look at the headlines and watch the stocks they own just going for a roller coaster ride they didn't sign up for. So, you know, yeah, mechanically they're probably healthy, but I think there's quite a lot of need for some re-regulation, certainly reining in some of the dark pools, some of the influences, the computer trading. There's a lot of things behind the scenes that need some changes.
Is it fair to say you're bullish on the markets? Are you bearish on the economy?
No, and I'll tell you why. Is you know, I spend an awful lot of my time when I'm not working on the markets traveling, and in particular motorcycling. And, you know, the reason I do that is because I want to get out and see the world. I want to meet people. I want to talk to them. I see what's going on, you know, sense the community, smell the air, really. And one of the things I've learned over the years is that, you know, you can bet against the markets, you can bet against the economy, but there is no way I'm betting against the people, because Americans in particular are resilient, clever. They are dynamic. They will move forward to the future. They will build a better life. Now, other people in other countries are similar. And so if you get to the human element of it, you know, I'm very much for the people. It doesn't matter where we're talking about, but, you know, it's the governments that are a problem now.
Got it. Really, like, I'm taking so many notes.
Oh, you're very kind.
Yeah, listening to you. I want to ask you another follow on, though. Like, I hear you, like, that you're not going to bet against people and whatnot. Let me ask you this, like, maybe, I don't even know if this is a good question, but maybe more just zooming out, looking at the state of things in the U.S., does our fiscal picture, I'm looking at like the debt situation, $34.6 trillion, does it matter? Like the rising deficits, does that kind of matter? I know maybe it's longer term or longer looking out further, but do you have a take there on the U.S. maybe a bit longer term? Are you optimistic that we'll solve it?
Well, it makes me, personally, I mean, that's an interesting question, right? Because, I mean, personally, it enrages me. I mean, you know, I was grown up, I earned everything I have. I did it the hard way. I sweat, blood, and tears, learning how to cut grass, move things, paid my way through school, working on stuff to pay for my living expenses. I mean, you know, so, I equate hard work with results, right? And I look at the way this world is working right now, this expectation of something for nothing, the debt, the constant piling on of this. Now, there are people who truly need help. Those people deserve it. They should get it. But this idea that we're constantly rewriting the rules to accommodate folks who don't want to put in the effort, don't want to put in the work, don't want to put in the time to get what they need, you know, that really annoys the snot out of me. So I look at this and I say, yeah, that debt matters. So far, they've played kick the can down the road. But as far as I'm concerned, this is not a Democratic or a Republican issue. This is a leadership issue. We don't have the right people in Washington who understand economics 101. It ought to be a precursor to sitting in an office over there. If you don't understand it, you don't get to be there. And you sure as hell don't get a pension on my dime.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good point. All right. One last question before I let you go. And I do not know the answer to this. Gold.
Neither do I, but that's
gold.
Okay.
Do you allocate to gold or have a take on gold? Because that seems to be a popular topic these days, especially on this channel.
Well, you bet I do. I think every investor should own at least some gold, right? And it's not for the reasons everybody thinks. The relationship, the domain of the late night television commercials and scores of clickbait artists would have you believe that it's a hedge against inflation. That's never been proven. And that's a very controversial take, but it's never been proven. What has been proven is the relationship between gold and other interest rates. Now, you know, people say it's time of crisis, it's this, that, and the other thing. I don't really care. What I care about is gold has the opportunity to stabilize everything else in my portfolio, or at least help stabilize it. So I want to own it, not because I expect it to go $5,000 an ounce, but because I know that if it doesn't go to $5,000 an ounce, then everything else in my portfolio is probably going to be doing okay.
Okay, stocks, gold. What else do you put in your portfolio? Bonds?
Real estate? Yeah, absolutely. Okay. You bet. You got to have a balanced picture, right? Everybody gets very focused and there's this sort of short-term lottery-like mentality that exists in this country right now. I think that's a disservice to investing. I think, you know, you've got to have some things that are just steady Eddie, high dividend, low beta choices. You've got to have some zoom to go with the boom, right? As we put it, and you've got to have some gold, you got some bonds, you know, real estate may or may not be considered an asset class. Some people like it. You know, I personally like some REITs. I'm not smart enough to invest in real property. So, you know, that to me is appealing income stream, but that's the kind of thing that gives me the stability to go pursue some of the NVIDIAs of the world or some of the Microsoft of the world that I know are going to be more up and down.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Keith, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I want to give you the final few moments here. Let folks know where they can find you, find your work, find your website, and let's leave the audience with a parting thought, something to think about.
Okay. Boy. All right. Where to start here? So the easiest thing, first of all, thank you for giving me the opportunity, is just go to 5withfitz.com or my name, keithfitz-gerald.com. And there's something called the 5 with Fitz. You know, it's my personal thoughts. I've written them for years and I started publishing them on a lark. I had no idea that people would find them so interesting, but today, we're distributed, 30, 40,000 people a day. It's totally free. It's just, it's me, it's irreverent, it's fun, and hopefully it's profitable. But that's where people usually get to know us. And if they like us, they come on board as a research client. But, you know, in terms of thoughts, right? This is right out of my martial arts experience. I've spent more than half my adult life, 3/4 of my adult life pursuing martial arts. And one of the things that you learn as a martial artist is that the world is always going to be complicated. So rather than live in fear of that complicating factor ruining your life, what you do is acquire the mental discipline and the tactics and the tools to go through life with the character that you want. So take a deep breath. As complicated as the world's going to be, the sun's going to come up tomorrow. And if we've got a path forward, we can take it.
Play to win. Well, Keith Fitzgerald, principal of the Fitzgerald Group, thank you so much for being so generous with your time, all of your ideas, your knowledge, your wisdom. Really appreciate you taking the time to come on today, Keith.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.